themselves. And it is with great pleasure I ask you to join me in welcoming them here today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Shireen, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen, from me. I first of all should apologize for the state of my voice. I got on a plane in Chicago on Tuesday evening and got off yesterday morning in a completely different state. I was fine when I left Chicago, and I arrived back yesterday croaking and in not a good shape at all. However, I get no sympathy from Hank for that, because I was in Chicago for a Morgan Stanley board meeting. So he clearly thinks that that's just what I deserve. Welcome, Hank. We have the format we usually have for these directors' dialogues is that I ask a few questions at the beginning and then at a certain point throw it open to the floor. And because we're in a university and people are interested and intrigued in how you make the transition from university to a career, I wonder if we might begin with a personal question about how you got into this business, how you decided at university that investment banking was what you wanted to do with your life, and how you actually managed to sell yourself to Goldman Sachs in the first place, since that's what a number of people in this room are seeking to do.
Well, Howard, you know, when I graduated from, like Howard, I have a bit of a problem with my voice. I got off a plane at 8 a.m. on Monday morning after, and I've had now going on 3 days here, going right through through dinner at 10 o'clock, and have been doing a lot of talking. But in any event, I graduated from college in 1968, and it was right in the middle of the Vietnam War. I actually thought I wanted to be an English major. I was very interested in going to Oxford and had a Reynolds scholarship and was going to thought I wanted to be an English professor. But it turns out I got into the Navy ROTC unit at Harvard and ended up going to Harvard Business School and went right from Harvard Business School to the government because I received an occupational deferment, and I worked for David Packard at the Pentagon. And to step back, if right out of business school, when I went to business school, I was 22 years old. I had never worked in business. I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I don't know what I would have chosen right out of business school. But as it turns out, I worked at the Pentagon. I went from there to the White House, and one of the things I learned was I liked working on financial problems. I worked in the tax area, minimum wage, pension reform, and so on. And I also came to the conclusion, after having worked for some people where it went very well and some people where it didn't work very well, that almost as important as what I did was who I did it with. And so at the time when I got ready to leave the White House, and I was 27 years old, I went through an extensive interview program, and I talked with people in all kinds of industries. I decided I wanted investment banking, and frankly, it was the people at Goldman Sachs, it was people like Bob Rubin and Steve Friedman and John Whitehead that made me want to be part of Goldman Sachs. And also, I was naive enough that I had decided I didn't want to live in New York City. For personal reasons, I wanted to live in Chicago, and Goldman Sachs convinced me I could live in Chicago and it wouldn't hurt my career. And I did that for 20 years before I moved to New York in 1994.
Well, so there's your answer. First of all, go to the Pentagon, which is an unusual route. Let's get to the position of Morgan Stanley at the moment. I mean, that in the last couple of years anyway, investment banks have been doing pretty well. I would say largely on the back of the fixed income business, but there has to be a question about the industry structure in the U.S., but also internationally. And only 3 or 4 years ago, when we saw the J.P. Morgan Chase deal in particular, there were plenty of people around who would say, this is the future that you're going to have to bulk up, that clients are going to want to have money lent to them, and unless you have a big balance sheet, it's going to be very difficult to survive in this business. And there were widespread forecasts that Goldman's would end up with Deutsche or whoever. I mean, there was a speculation every month or so. All that's gone quiet at the moment. But what do you think about the industry structure? Do you think there will remain a place for the pure investment bank, if you like, in the future? Or do you think in the end we will see huge conglomerates, because there will be it'll be essential to have a big balance sheet to operate?
Howard, that's a question I hear less today than I did several years ago. A number of years ago, when there was a lot of talk about consolidation, at that time, we saw it pretty clearly. We thought that size and scale were important, but we tended to think about size and scale in our basic businesses. So Goldman Sachs' strategy is to be a leading global investment bank, securities firm, asset manager. We didn't want to be a global financial services conglomerate. We recognized we were smaller than some of the biggest players. I maintained at that time that the term business model was overworked, that there were going to definitely be a number of big financial service conglomerates, Citibanks, J.P. Morgan types, that were going to be quite successful, and it was all about execution. And there also were going to be firms with different business models that would be very successful. And I've maintained, and I continue to believe, that if we weren't as successful as we wanted to be, it wouldn't be because we had the wrong business model. It would be because we weren't able to execute. And the key to Goldman Sachs is to integrate a strategy which involves integrating client service and the client part of the business with our principling and trading capabilities. And we would like to believe that we're as good as anyone in terms of dealing with clients. We've got a client franchise that's second to none. And we are as good trading as just about anybody. And the clients are increasingly asking us to make capital commitments, and they come to us because we've got strong capabilities in the market, so we need to integrate those two. Now, what you're seeing today is the press is starting to write that maybe some of the financial conglomerates need to break apart. And so you see the Citigroup selling off Travelers, American Express or their advisors. I think you're going to continue to see very successful financial service conglomerates, and that they will be continue to be successful if they execute properly, and we will be if we execute properly. But I strongly believe that size can be the enemy of excellence, and that the biggest challenge we have at Goldman Sachs is staying special at 20,000 people, as special as a word at 5,000 and 10,000 people, continuing to be the employer of choice in the industry, and to continue to strengthen our culture. And so that's what we're working on.
Now, the more current criticism that you hear, or whether it's a criticism or characterization, if you like, of Goldman Sachs, is you'll hear people say, well, Goldman Sachs is really just a hedge fund masquerading as an investment bank. Right. What's your answer to that?
My answer is it shows a lot of ignorance, but hedge funds are proprietary. And what they do is they trade to make money for themselves. And they don't, that's their purpose in being. That the vast majority of what we do is principling as opposed to proprietary. And the vast majority of the trading business really comes out of the franchise. We have customers come to us all the time to execute transactions. And great trading opportunities come out of that. I tell the story internally, and we talk about a couple transactions in our annual report, which illustrate, you know, this integration of the principling with the advisory business, or putting ideas together with capital. We actually worked on a transaction with Morgan Stanley as a merger advisor for four or five private equity firms buying some generating plants in Texas, the Texas Genco transaction. And I think each of our firms received an advisory fee, for the merger business. But Goldman Sachs also executed a very, very complex power hedging transaction, which involved major risk. There was huge value added to the buyers, and there was a very big profit opportunity in that for Goldman Sachs. Now, I would say it's a risk transaction. It's principling, but it comes out of the franchise, and that's the kind of opportunity no hedge fund would ever have an opportunity to execute.
Can we move on to the sort of business ethics and regulation, which obviously was my business for some time. But with the Bernie Ebbers verdict just day before yesterday, problems of WorldCom and Enron, etc., have come back into the headlines again. But rather than focus, specifically on Ebbers and just how many years in jail he's going to get, which looks as though it could be quite a lot. But as you look back now at the sort of five or six year period from 98, 99, and the great boom and the bust, and then the arrival on the scene of Eliot Spitzer and everything else. I mean, Goldman's have perhaps not been in the centre, but nonetheless you've been touched by these things like all the investment banks have been. What lessons do you learn now from what went on in the boom and bust, and how much do you think you could tell people that it won't happen again?
Howard, that's something we're all spending a lot of time thinking about. Actually, I'll get to it in a minute, but that's really why I'm in London this week. But to step back, the most general basic lesson, which we tell ourselves all the time, is that when you look at the boom and the bust, is that if something looks too good to be true, it generally is. And as I look at it, I wish I had done a better job of leaning against the wind just generally. My kids are now 32 and 30. I don't have grandchildren yet, but we still laugh about the fact. As a matter of fact, we were playing a game the other day even, and one of them wanted a do-over. And, I would love a few do-overs myself, but as I look at what happened and putting it in perspective, I think that we'd had a long period of expansion, and a number of business practices had become too lax. In industry in general, and in our industry in particular, our industry made its share of mistakes. Goldman Sachs made its share of mistakes. And one of the things that's most disappointing to me is that we didn't do a better job of positively differentiating ourselves relative to the competitors. And we have worked very hard with compliance programs. We've worked very hard to identify conflicts and seek to manage them. Now, in our industry, investment banking, there are many, many conflicts because we serve investors and we serve issuers. We act as a principal, we act as an advisor. I happen to think this is what lets investment bankers do tremendous good and create real value in the marketplace. And I don't think conflicts in and of themselves are bad. There are conflicts in almost every institution. The question is how you disclose them, how you manage them. So we're working to do that. But I remember, Howard, when you were a regulator and we talked about the principles-based approach in the UK, which I frankly think is far superior to the rules-based approach that we have in the US. But we have, and so one of the things that we're dealing with at Goldman Sachs right now, one of the things I'm dealing with is, let me say to step back, I think as hard as we work on compliance and as hard as we work on obeying all the rules, if people can always get around rules, and there's a bigger picture, which is to ask yourself what is right, make sure you do the right thing in a very, very complex world, which is changing. And so one of the things that became clear to me as I thought about our mistakes and thought about some of the mistakes I made is I felt a great need to talk with all of our managing directors about this. And so I'm right now, I have four of these meetings. I'm having 24 individual meetings going all around the world, where at the end of the period of time, I will have met in groups of 40 or 50 with our over 1,000 managing directors. And the sessions are on business judgment. This is not compliance, business judgment, accountability, leadership, taking responsibility for your actions, having a framework for making complex decisions. And so the question and the challenge I've given our people is how do we get ourselves to the spot where we go through another, if and when we go through something else like we've gone through, that we will differentiate ourselves, and how do we get ourselves to the spot where reputational judgment, business judgment, is a competitive advantage for Goldman Sachs. And so can I tell you that we're not going to be caught up in some other things? Absolutely not. I mean, the level of regulatory scrutiny and intensity that we see right now is very, very significant. So I see a need to continue to raise the bar at Goldman Sachs in terms of our focus on these issues. But I think we're making real progress, and I think we've learned a lot. And I frankly think it has been positive, and we're going to come out of this with an even stronger culture.
But do you think the regulatory pendulum has swung too far? I mean, when you look at Sarbanes-Oxley and its effect on the way your firm is managed, but also its effect on the way your clients are managed, do you think this has now gone too far with the triumph of process over substance?
Well, you know, in the U.S., I think the best part of the U.S. system is when there's a problem, we shine a light on it, and we move very quickly to clean it up. And I think the pendulum generally does swing too far in the U.S., and I think it probably has. I'm spending very little time thinking about that because I know not only that although you may not get this from the newspapers, the regulatory intensity is increasing. The SEC has 1,000 more people doing their job. Mm. There have been increases everywhere, and we've got, in the U.S., it's not as clear as it is here who the regulator is. We have various regulators and would-be regulators and attorney generals and what have you. So it's very complex. Now, and so we're just figuring out how to deal with it and deal with the world we have to deal with. But your question about Sarbanes-Oxley, I think, is interesting because we've had several big changes. You know, we've had Sarbanes-Oxley, right? We've had the independence of the listing rules for the New York Stock Exchange. We've had everything that's our industry's dealing with, the global research settlement. There have been a lot of changes. I argue that we don't want to see more regulation, but I think it's too early to really judge what's happened because I think we're still in the middle of the storm. And what we've gone through has been as significant as any major change in the U.S. since the Great Depression and the legislation that followed that. And I actually think most of Sarbanes-Oxley is good. And I think actually when you look around Europe, there are people considering even going further in certain areas. For instance, mandating rotation of auditors and so on. I think I'd like to live with it longer. I think I hope there'll be refinements in how it's implemented, and we will figure out how to use it properly. I know the SEC is working with their counterparts in Europe to harmonize the way this is going to work. There are certain parts that clearly are creating problems. When we look at auditor certification, auditors under Sarbanes-Oxley are not just certifying the financial statements, they now are certifying the controls. And this is a huge issue in the U.S., particularly for smaller companies. In Europe, it's even a bigger issue. So I think we're going to have to work some of those things out. It's hurt. I tell you, new listings are way down in the U.S., way, way down. And so a lot of people look at it and say, well, that's Sarbanes-Oxley. I think that's an oversimplification because what we find is there's competition in capital markets, and capital markets are broader, deeper, more liquid in Europe, in Hong Kong. And I also think that there also are some other inhibitors to companies listing in the U.S. other than Sarbanes-Oxley. Is a very, very tough enforcement regime in the U.S. And non-U.S. citizens are concerned about the legal system and the tort system and class action lawsuits and so on. So I think it's too early. I think Sarbanes-Oxley was, frankly, much more positive than negative. Hmm. And this is going to take us a while to get used to it.
On foreign listings, we had Bill Donaldson in that chair just recently. And he was keen to try to say that they were, you know, very concerned that the U.S. market shouldn't become the famous Roach Motel, and that you know, he was going to make it easier for people to delist if necessary. But in a certain way, you might say that was a curious thing for the head regulator in the U.S. to do—to make it easier for people to go.
Yeah.
But do you see a sign that more foreign companies leaving the U.S.?
Well, I focused much more. I don't think you're going to see many leave the U.S. I'm more focused on the decline in listings because, and as I explained to regulators in the U.S., Goldman Sachs doesn't have a particular vested interest. We are a leader in Asia, in Europe, and in the U.S., and we're a leader in equity underwritings in all spots in the equity markets and mergers. But when you look at what's happened, it used to be that 100% of the IPOs coming out of China were listed in the New York Stock Exchange. Mm. Since 2002, half of them have been, half of them have been listed elsewhere. It used to be that 30% of the IPOs out of Europe were co-listed in the U.S. I think you'd have to go back to 2002 since you found any dual listing. Dual listed. It's been several years since you've had an IPO listed on the New York Stock Exchange out of Japan. So there's no doubt that there's something going on there. And I think that's why, people are saying, has Sarbanes-Oxley hurt the competitiveness of the U.S. markets? And so I think that is a question, and that's what Bill Donaldson was trying to address. And what I tried to say is I think it's a factor. But I think people say Sarbanes-Oxley, and what they mean by Sarbanes-Oxley is a whole climate in the U.S.
Yeah.
Enforcement, torts, you know, the tort system, class action lawsuits. And I will hasten to add, I have no doubt that the foreign markets are more competitive. Mm. You know, so there's no doubt about that.
Yeah. Looked at from here, one of the curiosities about the American regulatory response is this, that one common factor for most of the big scandals in the U.S. has typically been an over-dominant CEO, uncontrolled by the board and allowed to make stuff up,
right,
to put it. I mean, let's not use legal technology, but right, we all know what terminology, right, but we all know what we mean. The response, and I know this because I sit on the Morgan Stanley Audit Committee, and so I know what this means, is a fantastic paraphernalia of systems and controls. And you may say, well, it's okay, but it is very, very detailed, okay?
Absolutely.
Here, we would say, and indeed this is not just a regulator in the UK, but any British corporate would say, well, part of the big answer to that is the split between the chairman and the CEO. And that is now what we do here. We all companies, I think bar none now in the FTSE 100, have a separation of the roles of the chairman and the CEO, and that is obviously your best guarantee against a company being run by an over-dominant individual. Why is that not obvious to people in New York?
Well, I would say, Howard, I think a number of the scandals you did have a separation. I don't think Bernie Ebbers was the chairman. I think it was separated there. I think there have been a number of, to step back a minute on that issue. I think the research, let me step back. The U.S. has had a long history of having the chairman and CEO be the same person. That in the U.S. where it's been split, it's tended to be troubled situations, underperforming situations. And a matter of fact, some of the the big scandals have involved companies where there is the chairman and the CEO were split. When people have done research on this matter, and when the conference board did research on the matter, it was very hard to point to superior performance with split chairman and CEOs, or being one and the same. Now, what I think is happening in the U.S., I think it's very quickly going to become a distinction without a difference. Because what has happened, and I think it's fascinating, is the listing standards, and I think you've probably seen this, the listing standards and Sarbanes-Oxley and so on, what you've seen is that the importance of independent directors has greatly increased. The compensation committees are independent directors, the audit committees are independent directors. Every company now essentially either has a lead director who is head of the independents, or someone that is de facto a lead director because, you know, the chairman of the governance and the nominating committee, the boards all meet in executive session without the chairman there. So I think that the U.S. is evolving in that direction, and if I were going to make a prediction, what I would say would happen would be there will be a number of instances where a current generation of chairman and CEO step down, and the next, and maybe the chairman and CEO will be a chairman for 1 year in a transition, and then they will separate the two. I don't think it is a bad idea at all to separate the chairman and the CEO, but I don't think that would have prevented, in and of itself, prevented the scandal.
Okay. I'm going to open it up in a second. I'll just start, just one further question from me, but that's just your warning that I shall come to you shortly, and I shall pick on people arbitrarily if nobody puts their hands up, so there's a threat. But at the Morgan Stanley shareholders meeting this week, the one serious resolution put was about top executive pay, about CEO pay, which of course has escalated as a multiple of pay dramatically in the US, particularly in the last couple of decades. And the proposition put forward by a number of investment funds, I think the Catholic, I forgot what it's called precisely, but it's a Catholic organization, is what a modest proposal that the CEO's compensation should be limited to 100 times the average pay of non-managerial staff. Now, you pay your people very well in Goldman Sachs, so that seems like a reasonable restriction. Are you in favor of that?
I'm not... Let me ask you, were you in favor of it for Morgan Stanley?
No.
Okay. I would say to do it, no, I'm not in favor of any specific formula, but I would say to step back, because I think this whole topic is an interesting one, because CEO compensation has always sparked a lot of interest and a lot of public interest, and I think that's a... It's a healthy tension in any free market system. The remarkable thing is that there's always been much more attention on it in Europe than in the U.S. And over the last 3 or 4 years after the scandals, this has become, I mean, the idea of something being on a, fortunately we don't have to deal with something like that in our proxy this year, but that would have been unthinkable 3 or 4 years ago. And the reason I think you're seeing it now, there have been real abuses, and there have been instances of people being very handsomely paid for failure. And so, again, my own view is what you're going to see is you're not going to see resolutions like that adopted, but you're going to see the impact, and the impact is a healthy impact of all of this, which is, I think, compensation committees are being much, much more diligent and more thoughtful. And I bet you're seeing it at Morgan Stanley, although you haven't been on the Morgan Stanley board for a long time, but I bet you're seeing it. And I think at Goldman Sachs and all over, being very diligent, I think you're seeing certain companies take, really put in long-term incentive plans, some very well-known companies, GE, IBM, and so on. Uh, the My view is that the compensation for CEOs, a big part of it should be equity, and that they should hold the equity for a long time. And one of the worst parts of the scandals was seeing CEOs, although Bernie Ebbers incidentally didn't do that, but many CEOs and some who aren't in legal problems got big compensation awards in equity, and then they sold that equity before the company had problems. And if a CEO doesn't know more about how his company's doing than the public, it's really peculiar. So I think getting your shares in common, I mean your comp in equity, and holding it for a long time is an important thing. But there is a basic difference, depending on which side of the Atlantic you're on, in my judgment, and it's a perception difference. In the U.S., having high levels of compensation is still aspirational. In other words, people believe if you do a good job, you should be able to make a lot of money and you don't need to be embarrassed about it. I think it's much more confused over here. I think there's more embarrassment for the people that receive high levels of compensation and more jealousy from those who don't and who watch them receive it. So what happens is, on this side of the Atlantic, there's a narrower band on compensation, but I still think there's plenty of examples of CEOs being richly compensated for failure. And so I think that's where you get the most criticism in both spots. And that's my view, but I would not react positively to you know, taking a formulaic approach or putting caps.
Okay. Questions from you. Shireen, so first.
First of all, sympathies for both of those sort of groups. I was just wondering, given that every other bank on the street has now spun off its private equity arm, do you see that happening to Goldman Sachs or not?
No, I don't. I would just say I'd be a bit careful when you say every other bank has spun them off, because I think you're going to find some of the banks spun off one of their private equity arms and are continuing to make some private equity investments. But I think that one of the things that I'm proudest about at Goldman Sachs is I think we've had an approach that's worked at private equity. We've compensated our people a little bit differently. It hasn't been just totally based on formulaically and how the fund is done. We've had a view for a long time that we take minority positions, we partner with other investors, and we've been able to run it successfully in the marketplace and within our culture. And I think you will find that a big reason that other banks have spun it off is they haven't been able to run it successfully, and it just hasn't worked for them.
Thanks. Next, give your names as well, please. Thanks.
Hi, Hank. I would like to ask, I know that Dr. Lawrence Kuhn, who's on the board of Citigroup, wrote a book about Jiang Zemin and then The Man Who Changed China, pointing out that Jiang Zemin has put new face China through his love about technology, science, and some important foreign policies. So, from your point of view, I know you have visited China like 68 times since 1992. Probably the figure should be updated now again. So from your point of view, since China now is currently leading by Hu Jintao, what do you think what is the challenge that Hu Jintao is facing to maintain the momentum of Chinese economy? And what kind of change that China should do to
Can everybody hear that or not? Basically, a question about what the challenge is now facing Hu Jintao and how he should maintain Chinese growth. And apparently, Hank has visited China 68 times since 1992. This is an unbelievable statistic, which you can confirm or deny.
Yeah, I have, and I'd say the reason I visited it so much isn't only because of business. It's not that there's it's important to Goldman Sachs, but I just got involved with some not-for-profit interests in China, and it's chair a conservation group, and there is just a spectacular area in Yunnan where you've got the four great rivers of China, the Yangtze, Mekong, Irrawaddy, and Salween within 50 miles, and Tiger Leaping Gorge on the Yangtze's 10,000 vertical feet. And actually, I had conversations with Zhang Zemin and the Nature Conservancy about, you know, encouraging him to become, we didn't use this phrase, but the Teddy Roosevelt of China with parks. And he was actually very supportive for parks in China. And then I'd spent time with Tsinghua University. So that's why I went to China so much. Now, I think that Zhang Zemin was a great leader. And I actually think Hu Jintao will prove to be a very fine leader also. And when you say what are the big the challenges, I think the overriding challenge, I think, which is going to go on for some time, is going to be, to step back, I think the right way to develop a country, I do believe economic development and economic freedom should come before political freedom. If that comes first, it's going to be more stable. But I think that the overall challenge that the Chinese are going to have, which is going to be a long-term challenge, is when you give the kind of economic freedom and go to a market-based economy, I believe that will be unsustainable if it's not matched by increasing political freedom over a period of time. Now, I think what Hu Jintao is so focused on is development away from the coastal areas and the big cities. And the China has a problem which is very similar to a problem in many other parts in the world, the big disparity between the haves and the have-nots. We have that in the U.S. and Europe. It's between countries, China versus Mexico or whatever. And so there are more and more demonstrations, more and more people concerned about their economic well-being, concerned about corruption. So, and he's quite focused on how do you get, you know, and with agricultural reform, you know, it doesn't make sense to have people trying to make a living off tiny plots of land. So how does he force or incent development? And right now, you know, there's a very interesting, I think, debate going on in China, because on the one hand, there is a lot of pressure from the U.S., and I think it makes economic sense for China to revalue the renminbi relative to the dollar. But there also, you hear a lot of rumors about many party people saying we're not going to get development farther inland in the provinces unless we raise wages in the coastal areas to help spur development. So there's a lot of issues, but I think the great thing about China is their leaders are very smart, very pragmatic, focused on solving the problems, looking everywhere for best practices. So I actually think they will manage through this, and I'm quite optimistic.
Thank you. Next. Yeah, do give your name.
Yeah, Stefan Feilhauer, I'm a student here. We've just seen, coming back to some points on regulation, with the research that's being generated by investment banks, we've seen the reports getting thicker and thicker just because the disclosures are getting so much longer. You've also seen some trends into some hard dollar research. And there have been some people talking about, well, you know, are we going to spin off some research arms? Are we going to have some conflict of interest keeping them within an investment bank? What is your view on Goldman Sachs, but also what's your view on the whole industry looking forward to 5 to 2 years?
Well, you've asked one of the most interesting and difficult questions, but if you take it from the 100,000 feet, on the one hand, there's some simple answers, and when you get down to implementing it, it's much more difficult. It's hard for me to believe that you're going to any investment bank to be credible and to be a real investment bank, you've got to be very involved in the equities area, and when you're selling equities to customers, you need ideas. people, matter of fact, all of investment banking in many ways is about putting, you know, capital, you know, behind ideas. So we're an idea business, and research is about ideas. And you know, the word independence gets used. I would rather use the word integrity with research. I mean, we are, as an industry, we serve investors and we serve issuers. And the one of the erosions of the business practices was that research got tilted, you know, it should have just been squarely there to serve investors, and there was just too much pressure from the corporate issuer community on that side of the house. So I do think that is back in balance now, and I'm not worried about the independence. The thing that I'm focused on is what you raised is the economic model, because the institutional equity community is under a lot of pressure. There are a lot of smaller institutional equity investors that aren't particularly profitable themselves. They've got a lot of issues, and there's no doubt that there's competitive pressure that are forcing commissions down, and reducing what people are willing to pay for research. So one of the things we're all working with is how to come up with the right value proposition, and how do we offer research, pay less, at a lower cost, and how do we do something that is distinctive and value added. And a lot of our focus, we're not spending any time at Goldman Sachs saying, gee, should we spin off research, or because we know we need research. Our thought process is on how do we offer something that is really value-added and really distinctive. And as you've said, just having thicker and thicker reports, although you're going to have a few pages just on the disclosures and laying out the conflicts. But the biggest thing, and we deal with institutions, so the biggest thing we need to do is say, how do we come up with something that where we do an even better job of adding value?
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, let me say there's been hedge funds are going to be here to stay, because what the hedge fund phenomena is people will clearly pay for superior performance. Now, I also think we have, I wouldn't use the word bubble, but there's a speculative high right now in terms of the formation of hedge funds. And I view that just being one manifestation of a sort of a global issue right now, which looks a little bit like a credit bubble, where there's so much money in the world chasing yield that risk premiums have been bid way down, and so people are paying up for CCC junk bonds. There's all kinds of leverage being put on. Yeah, with the private equity firms are able to leverage at 7x EBITDA certain places and sell debt. So is all this money looking for yield? One manifestation of this is hedge funds. And so there's a huge formation of hedge funds. I think that we have great investors that leave Goldman Sachs and are able to raise all the money they want on very attractive terms. We have people that weren't very good investors or weren't good traders that can still raise a lot of money. And so there will ultimately be a shakeout on as it relates to hedge funds. What I actually think the SEC, you know, that's been a big hallmark of Bill Donaldson to have at least some minimal registration. And so I think you've got to expect that. That's a sign of the times. I think regulators everywhere, when I talk with them, I mean, Howard could comment on this, but I think everywhere where I go, they're focused on hedge funds. So I think you will clearly see, you know, a certain amount of regulation. And I think they will also attempt to get at that issue by, you know, looking very hard at investment banks and regulating us even more. I mean, the interesting thing, and this is not a complaint, it's just an observation, and I've been on Wall Street when the crimes that people investigated were Wall Street crimes. As Howard said when he talked about Bernie Ebers or Enron or whatever, or you can look at Parmalat over here, the crimes have been really in the corporate sector or on the different people that touch the investment banks. And so the regulators are seeking to you know, see the banks as enablers and often drive better practices by regulating the investment banks. So I think that will have an impact on us also.
I should just correct you. We think of Parmalat as being over there, actually.
Over there. You're darn right. It sure isn't in the... It sure isn't. It is not.
And when you talk to...
And you haven't in the UK, and I will say, and I think it's a real testament to the system here. I think the way this market has developed and the growth in the market and the relative lack of problems and the regulatory approach and a principles-based approach in the UK, both in accounting and in regulation, I think could be a great model for the rest of the world. But unfortunately, we've got different legal systems, different political systems. You've got Napoleonic law. You know, you've got, and so unfortunately, as much as I'd like to just take what you have here and export it, we have to live. And one of the real challenges we have is we just live in multiple regulatory regimes, and it's hard to even keep track of all the different people trying to regulate us.
Yeah. Well, certainly you'd find that a number of corporate folk in this country would point out that, you know, we haven't had any problems here, and yet via American exports, the Americans are very generous people, as you know, even generous with their own legislation,
yeah.
And they export it through extraterritoriality. And then, of course, from the European Union. So we end up with a lot of solutions in this market for which there weren't any problems.
Yeah.
I will. We've got just a couple more minutes. I'll take maybe two more quickly. I'll take all those three together, and then you can do one round-up answer. Yeah.
I actually have a sore throat as well. Going back to your question about Chinese market, in the Chinese economy that you just described and the political situations in China, what are the opportunities that you see for Goldman Sachs in China, and as well as because there are many economic links with Japan and the surrounding countries within Asia, what do you see any opportunities in other countries as well?
Okay, we'll take the other two as well, and then we'll have one. Yeah,
Yul. Hi. Can you speak about your opinion of the current, wave of M&A activity that has been going on right now, and also the potential impact in a couple of years of like you said, the private equity firms able to get cheap financing, you know, and the effects of any bankruptcy going on in a couple of years?
And the third one just behind.
I'm going to go through these very quickly. First of all, the easiest one, the opportunities for Goldman Sachs in China, most of what we've done have been big cross-border transactions, very big IPOs, China Mobile, PetroChina, M&A transactions. We now have a domestic securities license, so we're going to be working in to develop businesses, but the China, you know, Chinese domestic securities markets are in very early stages of development. You're right in saying that we're a global firm, and our global clients have interest in China, and we're involved for the first time on a number of global M&A transactions. Legend or Lenovo doing the deal with IBM, we represented Legend. So there's that's I think that's pretty clear. In terms of the M&A, I think I heard two or three questions in there. First of all, I would say that although M&A is coming back, it is clearly below trend line. If you look for a long period of time, the trend line is M&A transactions should be somewhere between 9% of market cap. And I believe we're still below trend. I think we're below trend for a number of reasons. CEOs execute M&A transactions when they're feeling confident and when they don't feel that they're going to be criticized. And in the U.S., you've got a tough regulatory environment, and in Europe, you've got a tough economic environment. I see a lot of, you know, pent-up backlog or demand for M&A transactions. A lot of what people are talking about right now is a deconglomeratization or rationalization, some of the things I mentioned earlier. The question you asked about, which has been written about a lot, and I would agree with you, that this so-called credit excesses we see today in terms of investors looking to hold risky assets in order to get high yield, the seeds of the next wave of distress investing and future M&A deals are being sowed by some of those things. Private equity firms have done a lot of the deals, and I think many of them will be very successful, and some of them, you know, will need to be restructured or worked out. So I agree with you there. There is a question about Russia and Putin. Let me say, I've been to China 68 times, I've been to Russia once, okay? And I've met with Putin once in the U.S. I actually, when I was in Russia, I met with a whole bunch of government leaders. I met with Khodorkovsky, that dates me, so I met with him 3 weeks before he got put in jail. I met with a number of the other oligarchs. One of the most heartening things in Russia I did was I met in St. Petersburg with a group of about 20 young entrepreneurs, and they were members of a 2012 club. And what they said was that there were three scenarios. Scenario one was the country was going to be so corrupt and there could be so many problems they were going to have to leave. The second case was that they were going to be able to stay in Russia and they'd want to have their kids leave. And the third case was Russia would develop in such a way that they would be able to stay, be successful, and they'd feel comfortable with their with their children staying. And they were, many more of them were optimistic, much more optimistic than they'd been. And that was quite encouraging. I think that my own view is, despite all of the, and for Goldman Sachs, it's a very tricky thing. Because for Goldman Sachs, in China, it's easy for us to work on big transactions and the kinds of things that are a hallmark. In Russia, there's grave reputational risk, and it is very, very difficult for us to figure out which business, business selection issues, because there's so many issues surrounding the oligarchs. We did work we're involved in the M&A transaction where BP made the big investment in Russia, so we've been involved in some transactions. I actually think that the country feels pretty stable right now. It's largely driven by oil prices, and oil prices look like they're going to be high for a while. But Russia is trickier for us, and I think we and a lot of international players are still trying to get our arms around what it is that Putin is doing relative to the oligarchs. We would like to believe that the reason that let me put it this way, I won't say anymore. I'm not an expert on Russia. I'm watching it just like you are.
Thank you. Hank, one of the things I was told by your HR people as we arrived, and your recruitment people, was that there are more applications to Goldman Sachs from the LSE than any other academic institution in Europe. I doubt if that will change after today. I think one of the reasons is that there is an interesting survey of European students which asks them how many hours they expect to work in their first job. And the average for Europe as a whole is something like 44. Fiona will correct me if I get this wrong. The average for LSE students is 51.3. Now, I know that's only half the number of hours that they will actually work if they go to Goldman Sachs, but at least it's a little bit closer. So we're delighted you are here. I know that a lot of people are interested in your firm, and couldn't be a better signal of your interest in the LSE and its products that you've been prepared to spend some time with us.
Let me also say, you're not only at the top of the applications, you're always one or two or at the top in terms of the people we hire. And we have over 200 people at Goldman Sachs at the vice president level or above. And so we love LSE students. And when we ask ourselves why, it's because we think we operate at the sweet spot of global capitalism. And this is a great, diverse student body. You have a global mindset and very, very innovative people. And so, again, thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.